Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. I don't know about you, but whenever I go to an art museum, I like to read the descriptions of the art. Sometimes these wall labels help me understand the piece, but sometimes they don't. Christine Colson spent many years writing these very labels for the Metropolitan Museum of Art. This gave her the idea to try and describe people as works of art. And then Christine, being Christine, took this awesome idea a step further. Actually, I would argue she took it several staircases further. She decided to write an entire novel in the form of art museum wall labels. The result is One Woman Show, an incredibly immersive and innovative read.
Well, I worked at the Met, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, for 25 years, and one of my last projects there was to write the wall labels for the new British galleries that opened in 2020. And it was while I was working on those galleries that I had the idea to write labels about people, to treat them like intricate works of art.
So when you came up with the idea, it sounds like you were going to do various people, but then I guess my next question is, how did you decide to, you know, focus on the life of one specific person? That would be Kitty Whittaker.
Yeah, that's important because I did not plan to write a book about Kitty Whittaker. So it was cooking for a while, and then it came to the point where I really had to just try it, to try and write a label about a person. And I randomly picked a woman standing in the museum's galleries, a kind of typical patrician Park Avenue lady, and I wrote the first label, which is actually still in the book. It's about 3/4 of the way through. And I had no particular investment in that character. I called her Kitty, and eventually she kind of took over the book. Masterpiece, age 5, 1911. Caroline Margaret Brooks Whittaker, known as Kitty, born 1906. Collection of Martha and Harrison Whittaker, known as Minty and Wit. With arms folded in deliberate contrapposto, Minty and Wit Whittaker observed their daughter Kitty positioned in a strip of expensive morning sunlight. The 5-year-old knows she is being watched and adjusts herself to advantage. Her glaze glows, enhanced flawlessly by her subtle sculptural design. She is all fireworks, this golden child, a delirious display of Bernini verve and unrivaled wasp artistry. This was not a linear writing process. I didn't start in 1906 and then write through a century of her life. It was more of a test to me as a writer to kind of try this idea. And once I had that first label about Kitty, I kind of thought, well, maybe I should try and write 20 labels about her. And I just started thinking about moments that I could capture. And then I write on this big wall. So every time I write a label, I tape it to the wall. And so the story kind of spread like an ink blot as I populated this life with these moments to eventually create a kind of retrospective exhibition of a single person.
Mm-hmm. And I think that makes, like, your original idea of doing multiple people would still be really great. But I think you really nailed it by just focusing on one person.
Right. And you get the other people in there the way you would in a retrospective exhibition where the curator shows you like comparative material. So in terms of a museum approach to looking at this life, and there's a lot that Kitty has in common with the works of art we evaluate and critique all the time. You know, she's treated that way from her earliest childhood throughout her life. She's kind of collected and prized. And so that ability to kind of extend that treatment to her and then have to include other people around her in order to give her context is a very typical museum approach.
I'm curious about your creative process. Did you figure out what Kitty's life had been like before you started writing the novel, or did you make decisions as you wrote? I believe it was the latter, right?
Yeah, as I wrote, I would kind of, because I was also really trying to stretch the form. You know, label writing is very specific. You only get 75 words. There's a certain voice. There's a, you know, every word has to work. There's no throwaway phrases. So I'm working within a form, but then I'm trying to write a traditional novel that needs things like plot and character development and emotional connection. So as I was piecing it together, I was kind of aware of those two things working simultaneously, and I was trying to stretch that form to its greatest capacity. You know, could I write a funny label? Could I write an emotional label? Could I write a sexy label? Like, you know, what can you really do with this kind of constraint? How far can you push it?
Yeah, and you pushed it really far. As far as it could go, maybe even further. And it's such an innovative idea. It's got what ad man Ross Reeves called USP, the unique selling proposition, because I don't think there's any other novel like that. When you came up with the idea, were you worried that it was such an original idea that people might not be able to understand it?
I was worried if it was sustainable. I was worried if it could go beyond just being clever. So I had a lot of readers as I wrote this, particularly in the early stages, both art people and non-art people, to see whether it could be carried and that they could keep up with it and that they really wanted to turn the page. You know, the strategy of the book is really kind of the opposite of what you experience in the museum, where you look at a work of art and then you read a label to explain it. Here, I'm giving you the label. And every label is opposite a blank page. And so it's like the job is for you to conjure what I'm describing. So it's more like label as catalyst rather than explanation. Mm. And so I love the kind of pulling the reader in that way and making them complicit in the storytelling. I mean, that happens all the time in even traditional novels. You know, if you describe a battle scene or a dinner party, you're making that image as you read. But this kind of actually formally shows you what that's like. It's like a metaphor for reading, which I really love. That blank page is very powerful as you conjure Kitty. I never describe what Kitty looks like. I never describe what she's wearing. It's about what's happening to her and how she feels about that and what the context is for that. So I love the idea of pulling the reader in that way. And that's what I had to make sure worked.
Yeah, definitely. I find that some museum wall plaques can be hard to understand. And if I'm being honest, they are often kind of pretentious. But I think that you found the right balance of making the labels accessible and entertaining. How did you pull that off?
I mean, you're totally right. I mean, it's a notoriously boring form. So that alone might say that this was a mistake. But I really was interested when I was writing wall labels, I was really interested in energizing them. I like to write in the present tense rather than the past tense. I like to kind of make them active. I think a great wall label always drives looking to the object. So you are doing that work when you're writing a traditional label. So for me, to transform it into what I wanted to use it for, this kind of storytelling, I wasn't going to shy away from the language. I wanted to use the language, but I also think sometimes if language is used correctly, it doesn't really matter if you know what the word means art historically, if you know what I'm using it for. So, you know, at one point I talk about a guy named Buzzy McClure, who's a capacious terrine of a man known for his roving finial. I don't think you really have to understand, like, know exactly what a finial is to know exactly what I mean by it. So I liked playing with language. I love the sound of words. I liked that idea of letting people kind of do what they want with it. And I tested that a lot to make sure people didn't feel lost. I only define one word in the whole book up front. I define the word garniture, which is, you know, I use the terms of porcelain to describe Kitty quite a bit, mainly because it's a uniquely human kind of medium. You know, it's hard but fragile. You know, in Kitty's case, it's of limited utility, which was good for her. It's made of fire. It's easily moved around and grouped with others. And it's very hard to hide its damage. So that idea of kind of a very human medium for Kitty was important. And then when you group porcelain together, you call that a garniture, when you have like a matching group set of porcelain. And I had tested that on a number of Met colleagues, very senior Met colleagues, who all said they thought it meant parsley.
I can see that, like garnish, yeah.
Exactly. So I thought, you know what? I can't. Kitty and her garniture are so important because that's how I bring in her friends and these people she kind of travels through this century with. And I thought, I can't have everyone conjuring parsley through this. So that's the only definition I put right up front.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and thank you for doing that, because I was not familiar with the word either.
Yeah, and it's a very European decorative arts term.
Yeah, exactly. The early wall labels contain the line, quote, collection of Martha and Harrison Whitaker, unquote, Kitty's parents. In this context, the words collection of made me think that Kitty's parents were objectifying their daughter. Did you intend for the reader to have that thought, or am I totally on the wrong track with that idea?
No, I think you're right. I think Kitty, even that label that I read, you know, that you can tell Kitty knows she's being watched from the very beginning. I mean, she understands, and I kind of liked that about Kitty, actually, that she's very aware of what she's going through. She's very aware of the competition involved in the goal of marrying. You know, this is 1906 she's born, so these are early days. Some of this hasn't changed, but I found that the ability for Kitty to simultaneously participate in this societal practice and be aware of it and manipulate it when she needed to was important to kind of give her some agency.
Yeah, very well said. You wrote an essay for the Daily Telegraph in which you said that you're not sure we need museum labels. And that seems to me like a kind of an act of self-sabotage, considering your latest novel and your 25 years writing for the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Can you explain what you mean?
It's less anti-label than pro-looking. I'm really interested in people exercising the muscle of looking, because I think it's the much more satisfying way to experience a museum. And I think we're often meant to feel intimidated in museums and like there's something we don't know. I think art does the work for us. And if you're open to it and you spend some time with it, you'll get a lot more out of that than any label and 75-word description can give you. You know, when we ask someone to listen to a piece of music, we don't give them a 75-word description beforehand. We just let them listen to it. And either they like it or they don't like it, or they tap their foot, or they have some kind of very human response. And I think art can be exactly the same way. If you want to read the liner notes, then you can find out about that. And if you want to read the label, you can get some more specifics. But I think actually allowing yourself to respond to a work of art, to choose what you're going to respond to, not what we tell you is important, but what actually speaks to you. I think if something stops you in your tracks, there's a reason, and you should kind of excavate that and find out what it is. And that only comes from just allowing yourself to swim in the practice of looking.
Yeah, that's excellent advice. Very inspiring and very wise advice. What's next for you?
You know, similarly, I have an idea that's impossible to do. It's cooking.
Okay.
And when I write, I'm very ritualistic and almost superstitious about writing. So when that process starts, it's to the exclusion of everything else. So right now, I can't really do that. So I let it stew. And I, you know, we'll see. We'll see. And maybe it becomes something else. But right now, it's nice to have it, because I think there's a there's energy in that.
Christine Colson, thank you very much for joining us today. Congratulations on One Woman Show. It's one of the most innovative novels I've ever read.
Thank you so much.
Christine Colson is the author of One Woman Show. Find out more about Christine and her book at wpr.org/beta.
All definitions are valid because Christmas movies were never really a genre historically. The label came later with hindsight.
Coming up, Jeremy Arnold puts the tinsel back in Tinseltown when he gives us the lowdown on the history of the Christmas movie. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.